I was just thinking about some of those cats and thinking to myself, the person that I'm playing is a real person somewhere in the world. I want to do that character justice. And because it was personal to me, I wanted to do the story some justice. I wanted it to be as true as I could and do some justice to the stories for them.
Deirdre Didi Lovejoy, Assistant State's Attorney Rhonda Perlman.
I was shocked when I got cast because when I got the call, my agent said, this is an HBO show and there are two female parts in it. I was like, right, I am sure that I am going to be cast as sort of the kind of on-again, off-again interest to the main character. I was like, that's not me. I am not that girl. I am not. As a result of that, I just thought there was not a chance in hell that I would ever get cast. I walked in the waiting room, and every award-winning actress that you could name was there, and lots of my colleagues were Tony Award winners and much more beautiful than I am. I would consider myself always a character person. I'm a leading lady, but on the theater, generally. I was so relaxed. I just visited with all of my friends. I didn't think twice about the audition because I knew there wasn't a chance in hell. I did my audition, and a couple days later, I got a call that there was interest, and I went for my callback, and I still knew that there wasn't a chance in hell. I did my reading, and David was there, and Robert Colesberry, and Clark Johnson. I was trying to quit smoking for the 90th time back then, but I had my little nicotine patch on my chest. I went to put my microphone on, and the nicotine patch was showing. I was like, oops, sorry. That's my patch. I'm a little spacey today, but it's because I've got my patch on. I don't know if that made me more relaxed or whatever. And I booked it. And I didn't have to screen test. I can't remember if I had this conversation with David Simon or if I sort of gleaned it from several conversations with him. But they auditioned a lot of people for that role. They just didn't quite know what they were looking for. They knew they were looking for something, but they didn't know what it was. That is why there were really beautiful people and people like me. They said that when I walked in the audition, they were like, that's her. That just happens once every million years, and the stars align for an actor. It wasn't anything I did better or worse than I usually do in 1,000 other auditions, but I am eternally grateful that it happened to align for me to be part of a project that wound up being sort of historically significant.
Jim True Frost, Detective Roland Prez Presbaluski.
For all I knew, it was just another cop show. I had worked a single episode of Homicide, and Clark and David and Bob all remembered me from that.
Uta Brisewitz, Cinematographer.
When Bob Colesberry called, I had just moved to Los Angeles from New York and also had changed agencies. At one point, I got a call saying I had an interview for The Wire, this HBO pilot. I seem to remember my agent saying, we got the in, but don't get your hopes up. When I had my meeting with Bob, Bob told me that he was the producer that had brought Michael Ballhouse to America and then kind of hooked him up with Martin Scorsese. Of course, I was very impressed by that story because Michael Ballhouse was the cinematographer that German cinematographers looked up to. Everybody was aware of who Michael Ballhouse was. Just taking that away from the meeting, I felt like, oh, cool. I met the producer who brought Michael Ballhouse to the States. At the same time, Bob Colesberry also kind of let me know that he considers himself somebody who can find new talent and bring people up. At that point, I didn't really apply that too much to myself. I really thought I was just getting a meeting as a courtesy to somebody at my agency, and that's all. I had no expectations. The entire time, Bob passionately was talking about the show. He asked almost nothing, no information from me. I didn't get to say anything, but I remember walking out of the meeting, calling my agent, like, I think this was the worst meeting I ever had because I didn't really get to say anything. In retrospect, I learned that when a producer passionately talks about the show, it kind of indicates that they already made up their mind about you, and what they are doing right now is trying to sell the show to you.
Andre Royo, Reginald Bubbles Cousins.
I was off to Baltimore. We wasn't going to start shooting for 3 weeks or so. I had time to really get on top of this and doing this character justice. Not knowing about that addiction, that's when I started doing my homework. I started doing what I thought would best serve me, understanding what this character's going through, why he's making the certain choices that he makes. That was exciting. That's when all your acting classes and all your teachers, all that stuff you can put into practice. You can go, what's my objective? How do I get into this person's head? You start doing your homework. It was awesome. It was exciting to find different ways. I found out just talking to people. I talked to a ton of people. This woman named Fran Boyd was out there in Baltimore, and she helped me out a lot. She was a recovered addict. She was the one they based the character on in The Corner, the miniseries. She was dope. We really hit it off. She had no apologies and took me around all over Baltimore, talking to people in the midst of their addiction or coming out of their addiction or fighting their addiction. I was looking for a gimmick. I was just trying to find little movements that I can do that would just automatically go, oh, he's a junkie. I didn't find it. Everybody was different. It got me a little scared. They were talking to me like, please don't fuck it up. This is heroin. We're not crackheads. There's a difference between a crackhead and a meth head. There's a difference between a meth head and a heroin addict. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? I watch the movies. They all act the same to me. I got deeper into understanding not about the addiction, but about the person. I started looking at myself like, what do I do? One day I was in New York and I was going somewhere and I saw these people standing outside smoking cigarettes. I think it was one of those 0-degree days. I was like, what the fuck would make somebody come outside and smoke a cigarette outside in the cold? I started going, wait, you know what? They do whatever it takes to get that fucking nicotine. That's the same thing as Bubbles getting this heroin fix. What do I do every day? I found out. I started studying myself. When I come in the house, no matter what back then, I would turn on the TV. That's the first thing I would do. I would drop my keys, turn on the TV, then go about my business. I was like, why? Why do I turn on the TV? Then I made a list of things I do every day. I always drink Coca-Cola. I was a Coca-Cola fiend. I didn't like water. I was horny. I was trying to make love to my wife or my lady at the time every day. For about 30 days, I didn't do any of that. When you go in your house, like day 7, and you don't turn on that TV, you start fiending. You're like, damn, I just want to see a commercial. I just want to see who won the game, the Knicks or something. I couldn't turn on the TV. I'd be pacing around the living room trying to think about, what if I turned on the TV just once and turned it off real quick? I started building this need and writing down how I act when I'm agitated, or I'd be mad at myself when I couldn't have Coca-Cola. I started writing all that stuff down, and that helped me build the desire that I thought Bubbles would have every time he woke up. You start by getting high. There was a couple of movies. There was 2 movies that I saw. I never subscribed to watching other actors, but I was in New York, and I just wanted to see certain ideas and feelings. I watched The Panic in Needle Park with Al Pacino. With him, with that character, you just saw him. Every day he was trying to get high. His character would be looking on the floor because he might find cigarettes or something. Lady Sings the Blues with the other one. I remember watching that with my mom and dad. Richard Pryor had this small part. He was such a cool dude. Funny. He was a junkie. He got high, but he was functional, played the piano. When he died, it was heartbreaking. It was awesome that he wasn't in the movie that much, and he was a cool guy, a nice guy, just a down-to-earth guy. He just had an addiction. I fell in love with him. I was like, that's what I want Bubbles to be. I want Bubbles to be a human first, addict second. I wasn't trying to play the addiction. I was going to play the person.
Lance Riddick, Lieutenant Cedric Daniels.
We all had an opportunity, at least the cops, to spend time with other cops. I had to spend a day with a narcotics lieutenant. At the time, he was also going back to school at night at Johns Hopkins to get his MBA. I later found out from David that that's a fairly common thing for cops to move up the promotion ladder to get advanced degrees. 2 things that I remember most about that guy were how he talked about leadership. I remember him saying, in a lot of ways, you have to treat people like your children. You have to be firm with them, but you have to be compassionate. He also said that whenever he would go in to arrest people with waves of his people, go in front so that they know that he was doing it from the front. The other story that he told was telling, because that was when I started to understand the mentality of what it is to be a cop. They had figured out that there was a dirty cop on the force. They raided the guy's house. He was the first person on the guy. Apparently, the guy went to reach in his dresser, and he thought it was for a gun, and he said, "Please reach for it, because I would love nothing more than to blow you away, because I fucking hate dirty cops." That stuck with me, because not being a kid from the streets and not having grown up around law enforcement, I realized just how much there has to be underneath the surface, because that's the world that you're dealing with. You have to have that level of savagery and ferocity that you have to be able to call up in an instant and be able to tame and put away in an instant.
Seth Gilliam, Sergeant Ellis Carver.
The ride along was terrifying for me. It started off with him giving us bulletproof vests, and I thought, well, this can't be good. And then at one point, Dom Lombardozzi and I were sitting in the back seat. This is after he had already jumped out a couple of times. The officer, his name was Superboy, and Parker, his partner, was still behind the wheel. But at one point, we're driving along, and the car suddenly stops, and the doors slide open, and they all jump out and start running to some people who they're trying to corner. We're just sitting in the back of the car, both doors open, and I'm thinking, my head is going to explode at any moment. My head is going to explode at any moment. I'm sitting there protecting my head. I was sure that I was going to get shot in the head from behind. It was a bit of a rush at first. Aside from that end, it was pretty uneventful. Those guys went from 0 to 100 miles an hour in a moment's notice. They'd be joking with each other and joking with each other, and in 2 seconds, the entire energy would change and shift among them. Then they had each other's backs. It was very much like a fine-tuned machine, in terms of being able to turn it on and turn it off. Also, the interactions that I saw them having with the people in the neighborhood, everybody knew Superboy, and he would be jumping out, and he would have his hand on his gun behind his side. Then things would just stop at one point, and it was like, this guy's pretty serious, because he knows who's dangerous and who's not at this point.
Sonia San, Detective Shakima Kima Greggs.
Like most black folks who grew up in underserved areas, I did not have a positive view of the police. For me, that was my main obstacle to playing a cop at the time. I had to get over my own sort of early traumatic interactions with the police and what I had experienced. My early interactions with the police in my childhood were never positive, and that had affected me more deeply than I had imagined going into the show. I realized for me to play this character, I had to have some understanding of the motivations of good cops and what the motivation was for a good cop to become a cop. Kima was the good cop. She's the moral compass of the police. For me to embody that truthfully as an actor, I have to be willing to understand that that kind of cop existed and how that kind of cop came into being.
Melanie Nichols King, Cheryl.
In my audition for the show, they had told me, the executive producers, not to be too upset that I wasn't getting the chance to continue to read for Kima because she was going to die. When I met Sonia and we were hanging out, I said, "I think that's really horrible that they're killing Kima off." Then Sonia was like, "What? What are you talking about?" I was like, "Oh, shit. That's what they told me. I totally told them that it was a bad idea, and how could you do that? You finally have two lesbian characters on a national show. How are you going to kill off one of those characters?" I would like to believe that it was because of me fighting for it that they didn't kill her off.
Sonia San, Detective Shakima Kima Greggs.
She revealed that to me during the pilot when I met her, thinking I already knew the information. It was a shock for me to learn that the character was actually slated to be killed off. For the first, I'd say, solid 10 years of my acting career, I was always questioning the profession itself. I did not have a lot of respect for it. I had people coming to me during my poetry years thinking that I was an actor because of the delivery of my poetry. For me, it was very offensive that you would think I could be involved in such a shallow business as the entertainment business, and that I would even want to endeavor to choose a career that at the time I thought was so vain. It sent me into a questioning of the integrity of the producers because I felt that if that was the case, then why not just tell me off the bat, just so I know? People get these jobs and you assume that you at least are going to have a year's worth of work. You're going to be a part of the full show if you book a job as a series regular. This was the first show that I had booked, so I didn't really understand the business side of these contracts at the time. I didn't know at the time that even though I was a series regular and I had signed the contract for 5 years, that they could actually kill me off at any time. That would be fully within their rights. Because I didn't know that and had an expectation that I would be a part of the show as a series regular for the duration of the show, when it was introduced to me during the actual pilot that I'd be killed off, that ends up being a one-season recurring role. It's not a series regular. I'll have some episodes and then I'm gone. Why not just present that to me from the beginning? Because I had come from a place of really struggling and meeting my bills at the time, I had felt some level of relief having booked a job. That's why it came as such a shock. It was just like, why not just be up front and tell me about it? For me, that signified to me the kind of bullshit about the corporate business world. I've always been a bit of the anti-establishment side of things. I had very radical opinions about capitalism and the corporate structure. For me, having people not be transparent up front about it, my anger really was based in that. My anger really came out of that, and then because I felt like if these producers who were presenting the business side of things for me at this time, based on my limited knowledge of how the business worked, were of high integrity, then they would have been transparent with me about the information right off the bat. What means something to the people who are putting the show together is the show. They have a show and a vision that they're trying to execute. For me, in not being transparent about that, it meant that there was no care or concern for the people involved, for the human aspect of what an actor who is booking a job and raising a family and making plans on how they need to move.
David Simon, creator.
Carolyn Strauss was the one who said, "That character has legs. Don't kill that character so quick." She was wounded and not killed at the end of season one, and Carolyn made compelling arguments about the show going forward and the need for a strong female lead on the cop side, that we were short on female leads, and that it was a perspective that could allow us things that we otherwise would not have. Carolyn came back to Ed and I, and I remember saying, "Man, Carolyn really wants Kima to go on. What does that do to the show?" We trotted it out a little bit and said, "You know what? Okay. It doesn't allow McNulty's darkness to go as deep that he got her killed rather than wounded. It closes some doors to us dramatically, and it opens others."
Carolyn Strauss, President, HBO Entertainment.
I just thought she was a great character. Yeah, she was supposed to have an untimely demise. I think it boiled simply down to I thought she could be really good for the rest of the storytelling. She could be really useful to him. It was just a different stripe. Number one, different from anybody else in the show. And number two, different from anything that we've seen before.
Two, like a novel. The pilot's complexity alarmed a number of the show's actors, and they openly wondered among themselves who would watch it. Several figured that HBO would pass on picking the show up, and they expressed surprise when the network signed off on it relatively quickly. Surprising especially when one thinks of the later impassioned pleas needed from David Simon to secure future seasons. David Simon and Bob Colesbury deliberated opening theme songs for weeks before Tom Waits, Way Down in the Hole, beat out John Hammond's iteration of Get Behind the Mule. The show used a different version of the song each season, with the Blind Boys of Alabama recording the initial rendering. The Wire, beyond a hiccup involving the iconic orange couch following the filming of the pilot, was off and premiered on June 2nd, 2002. The Wire's first season, and loosely to the antiquated, real-life wiretap investigation of Melvin Williams. It bypassed television's traditional, redemptive narrative for a 13-episode exposition on the futility of the war on drugs. The audience gained perspectives on characters ranging from high-ranking police officials, such as Deputy Commissioner Irvin Burrell, Frankie Faison, and Major William Rawls, John Doman, to low-level drug dealers, such as Wallace, Michael B. Jordan, and Preston Bodie Broaddus, J.D. Williams, to drug addicts turned informants, such as Reginald Bubbles Cousins, Andre Royo. Detective Jimmy McNulty, Dominic West, watches as D'Angelo Barksdale, Lawrence Gilliard Jr., escapes a murder conviction through witness intimidation orchestrated by Stringer Bell, Idris Elba. McNulty's complaints to a judge infuriate his police superiors, who initiate a haphazard detail that is designed to superficially appease the judge. In real life, Ed Burns said he had told the state's attorney, who went to a judge, that the police department should be more proactive in its investigations. He called up the deputy commissioner, who in turn called my captain, who in turn screamed at me as I was walking out the door to go work on that case, Burns said. Sure enough, at the end of the case we brought back, he was very, very happy, and then they tried to get rid of me. Largely through McNulty's stubbornness and disregard for his future in the police department, the ragtag detail infiltrates the drug ring by using a wiretap and pager clones, as D'Angelo begins pondering the morality of a life spent dealing drugs. The case's tentacles spread into the political spectrum, an area that the police chain of command refuses to visit. The police command prematurely reels in the case, once a cop is nearly killed in an undercover operation gone wrong, with elusive kingpin Avon Barksdale, Wood Harris, sentenced to a light charge and Stringer left free. Critical reception initially varied. Those who viewed The Wire's singular episodes as chapters in a novel appreciated the show. The Wire is compelling in its complexity, heartrending in its humanity, and surprising in the ways it finds to spin the conventions of cop drama, wrote Steve Johnson of the Chicago Tribune. After reviewing 5 episodes for the New York Daily News, David Bianculli described the show as interesting but slow. But without characters to care for, much less root for, I'm not exactly burning with curiosity, the way I am with most of HBO's other series, he wrote. The New York Post's Adam Buckman ventured further. If I were from there, I'd really be offended, he declared. As it is, I'm not from Baltimore, so I'm put off only by Simon's new show, which demonstrates, if nothing else, that even the vaunted HBO can cough up a dud once in a while. Uta Brisewitz, cinematographer.
I read the pilot several times because I felt like there was a lot going on. Many characters are being introduced. I felt like this is something really complex we're setting up here. Even I sometimes felt confused shooting the pilot.
Laura Schweigman, script supervisor.
I was there for the scene with a shooting where Snot Boogie was killed and lying in the street. That was my first really long overnight shoot I had ever done. Everything was just very real. If you looked away from the movie cameras, I just thought to myself, wow, I see this. I see this when I drive around in Baltimore. It was sad, but it was, at the same time, amazing how real it felt, how real it looked.
Benjamin Bush, Officer Anthony Colicchio.
That first scene with Dominic West and Snot Boogie, you already knew the show got the street right. It was beautiful in its depiction of that space. The ugly alleys were fascinating. It was a strange combination in The Wire of both cinematic beauty and that play with the line between that and photojournalism, documentary filmmaking. Those two were combined almost like William Friedkin and The French Connection. I was a visual artist. My father was a writer. The Wire combined the two for me. I enjoyed it visually, and it was just so smart. the way it went after a story. The Wire didn't allow you to predict anything, much like your life. It didn't allow you to guess who would succeed or how and who would fall with any accuracy. The Wire was a show of shit happening, and it happens to you, over and over again. You either bring it on yourself or you're a collateral casualty, or you feel for someone else who falls. You talk about how drama intersects. I was on the set when my father died. He died of a heart attack in New York City while I was finishing a scene I knew he would love. I, being a particular bastard, I was pouring out some beer in a guy we were arresting. That scene where we're just busting people for anything, open alcohol laws, etc. I went to Dominic West's trailer to have him sign copies of Rockstar, which had come out. I have a number of friends who are musicians. We all love that movie. Dominic West plays the guitarist. I went from his trailer home to my wife with the phone. I turned right around and raced right to New York, right through Baltimore where I'd just been. So I was actually on set thinking, my dad's going to love this scene. He loved The Wire. That's as far as he made it with that season. He never saw all that work.
Karen Thorson, producer.
We had to fight to keep the epigraph because the Directors Guild does not like anything between the director's name and the show. The director must get the last credit, and their claim was, well, you can't have the title of the show after the director's name. The director has to come after the title of the show. We said, but this is not the title of the show. This is an epigraph. It is part of the show. It is the first frame of the show, so the director's name is coming before the first frame of the show. Getting that layout needed to be approved by the guild. Nowhere in the episode does the title of the show ever appear. Episode 1 is The Target, but the epigraph is When It's Not Your Turn by McNulty.
Vincent Peranio, production designer.
The first season takes place in Section 8 high-rise housing. 6 months before, Baltimore tore the last high-rises down, so we didn't have any high-rises. We were scouting around, looking, and found some Section 8 housing that were low-rises next to a high-rise for senior citizens. So every week, I had to take the bottom 3 floors of that building and put cages up and make it look like Section 8 housing. We were walking through the low-rises in that neighborhood, and there, by a dumpster, was that orange couch. It was from the 70s, Mediterranean, crushed orange velvet, and torn and soiled, but it seemed perfect for the script. I asked the people in charge of the housing development if I could just put this in a vacant house or something just until we started doing the film. They did, and a month later, when we started working on the film, we put it in the middle of the court, and it surprisingly became a main part of the script. It was the hangout. Well, we did our pilot. It came out nice, and then the show was over until HBO decided whether to pick it up, which usually is months of waiting. Within 3 weeks, they decided to pick it up. I was talking to my decorator. I said, well, at least we have the orange couch. He went mute. I said, oh, no. You didn't do it. You didn't do it. He said, yes. We threw it out.
Nina K. Noble, executive producer.
I had to go back to Vince Peranio and say, you know that couch that we got rid of? We need to get it back. Of course, we couldn't get it back, so we found a couch that was very similar, and Vince found a fabric that was somewhat similar, and we got it reupholstered and hoped that David wouldn't notice.
Vincent Peranio, production designer.
We just started designing the couch all over again. We had it built. We had to go to England to get orange crushed velvet, which was not particularly in the 2000s. Then, when it was finally totally finished, we aged it, cut it up, pulled the stuffing out, and it looked pretty close to the real thing. We just set it up there in all its glory the first day of shooting, and nothing was mentioned about it again.
David Simon, creator.
I didn't know it at the time, no. He told me later in the season, once we'd established. He said, we had a little bit of an emergency with the couch. They sold the second couch as the first.
Nina K. Noble, executive producer.
That was the irony of it. That was a cheap thrift shop couch which we then had to custom upholster at great expense in order to duplicate.
Vincent Peranio, production designer.
It really kind of became an icon, the orange couch. A year into filming, I was reading a New York Times magazine, and the cover of the magazine was about new urban fashion, and it was an orange couch in the middle of a Manhattan street, so I know somebody had seen the film that year.
Uta Brisewitz, cinematographer.
In the pilot, we established when we go to the projects, we go handheld. After a couple of episodes, I approached Bob Coulsbury and I said, what these drug dealers are doing is so well thought out. I just don't see like it deserves any less control, visual style, or elegance than we are trying to apply outside the projects. If anything at all, we should portray them the same way. That's where I think we change things, and we were all shooting the projects from Dolly instead of just going handheld there. He agreed, and he went with it. And that was the great thing and the wonderful thing with me and my collaboration with Bob. Bob just really liked what I did, and he gave me freedom. He was just supportive. He was the guy behind the monitor, and he was nodding his head and giving the thumbs up. It was a great way of working. I experienced unbelievable freedom while I was working on The Wire.
Karen Thorson, producer.
Uta and Bob really collaborated well. I see a lot of homages to certain setups that Bob particularly liked. He liked the work of Gordon Willis. In Rawls's office, Rawls is standing against the window, emerging out of the darkness, when he has that encounter with McNulty, flipping the two birds when he's really angry with him for having stirred up business with the judge.
Debbie Young, makeup department head.
I used to work for the police department when David would come in to get the stats from the things that had happened. I worked in the 911 center. This is way before The Wire. Because I knew that Ed was a homicide detective and that David was a journalist, I had to make sure that everything was on point, because they would know if it wasn't, as far as how the person looked when they died. My key makeup artist, Sandy, had found this pathology book, and we had it in the makeup chair as one of our reference books. Because it had real dead people in it, I couldn't look at it. It just bothered me so much to see these dead people and how they had died. The photographs were very vivid. We had a consultant from the medical examiner's office when we started. What I did to get around that, when I would read something in the script and they would have it so vividly described in the writing, I would call the medical examiner's office to speak to the consultant, and I would say something like, so if I had a body that's been floating in the harbor for 30 days and it's in the middle of February, how would he look? The medical examiner would then describe it to me, and then I would jot down his description, and then I could translate it into makeup. It was the easiest way for me.
Bruce Latecky, sound mixer.
They were convinced in some ways that the wiretap had to be really sort of dirty and hard to hear, but we also had to give the audience something to listen to, so there was always a back and forth about that. A ground was found where there was enough information for people to follow along, but not so much that it didn't leave a sense of mystery to the whole procedure. It being called The Wire and being about wiretapping, it was about the eavesdropping and listening in. That was a really important thing on that show. You really had to listen.
Karen Thorson, producer.
Tom Waits wanted to see what we were up to visually and how the story was coming, and he wanted to see a cut of the show, which made sense. When we were producing The Wire the first couple of years, we were still using VHS for screeners. We had a timeline, and so we FedEx him a VHS player and a tape, and he says, well, I got the tape, but I don't know how to work the machine. I have to set it up, and my wife's the only one that can do that, so that'll be tomorrow. That made David Simon chuckle. There was nothing we could do. We had to wait for the machine to get set up so he could watch it. And he called fairly quickly after seeing it and said he would participate. What was interesting is changing the performer from season to season. That wasn't clear to me right away that that's what was going on in David's mind. And I'm not sure that he had that fully formed either. He wanted the voice of the vocals to reflect the main theme of the content of the season. That's why we have kids doing it, for example, on season 4, when the focus of the storyline is what happens to the kids and how they get into the drug trade or how do they avoid it.
Blake Lay, music supervisor.
While we were working on the pilot, I wrote the tune that became the end credit music for the show. Still, from seeing the pilot episode, I didn't have a very high opinion of the show. It just seemed to me like a slightly more glitzy cop show. I didn't understand HBO. To me, they seemed like a functionally inexperienced kid. Then, a couple months later, I remember also having an exchange with Nina Noble, where we were watching the finished mix and there was a scene with Wallace in it. And I remember saying to Nina, maybe someday someone will make a TV show where they star that character. I'd like to see that. That would be much more interesting to me than this copsy joke stuff. She said, well, if we get to really make the show, maybe we'll go there and you'll stick around to see that. I was like, yeah, right. That was my beginning on the show. Then the show got picked up and they asked me to come back and work on the sound, but also the music. Honestly, I still wasn't very excited about it.
Ed Bianchi, director.
I do like the idea that there was no scored music for the show. It went to the realness. It was so raw. I think that was part of it. Nothing was sweetened. Nothing told you what to feel in terms of music, where music usually pushes you. Just words and pictures are telling you.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
When they said action, first day we started shooting, I pretty much stayed in character as much as I could, because I didn't want to fuck it up. I knew that I'm a people person. I like talking to people. I like being around people. I said, I don't want to be going back and forth because I don't know if I have the discipline to jump in and out of character at that time. It was my first show. I was like, let me stay in character as much as I can. I stayed in character. I stayed by myself a little bit. I stayed in the trailer until the last minute. They put me in my wardrobe. I wore it as much as I could just to feel the dirt and the grime of somebody being out in the street all the time. The first scene we shot was me and Johnny going to just cop something. Easy fiend. It wasn't that much dialogue. It wasn't a wordy scene. We just go to the corner, go into the pit, and buy something and walk away. I remember doing a scene. It was the first take. I did it, and director Clark Johnson came up to me, and he's like, that was great. That was good. We're going to come in closer now. That was a wide shot. You guys are doing good. He pulled me to the side, and he was like, are you going to be you, or are you going to be Ratso Rizzo? I was like, what are you talking about? He was like, nothing. I was just saying, I see a little too much Ratso Rizzo. I was like, what the fuck does that mean? I walked away, and I started thinking about it. I remember seeing Midnight Cowboy with Dustin Hoffman as Ratso Rizzo. He had this little walk. He had this little shuffle. I guess, unbeknownst to me, I was doing that little shuffle. I didn't know I was doing it. But when he said that, what happened was this whole internal challenge in my mind was like, I'm no fucking copycat. I'm not doing that. I'm doing Bubbles. I'm not doing Ratso Rizzo. I really had to trust myself and concentrate even more. In my mind, it felt like one of them Jay-Z songs. Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Dre. This is my character. It worked, because all of a sudden, I just really started having blackout moments. When the director yelled, cut, I didn't know what I just did. I was just in the moment. I was in the zone. Bubbles was doing what Bubbles would do. It really forced me to be more method without being in the danger of actually taking drugs. You always heard that in acting class. Acting is not doing, it's being or some shit. I think I really just became Bubbs. Bubbles became me, so to speak. After that, the whole first season, I couldn't tell you what I did in the scenes. I had to rewatch it. I don't remember some of the stuff I did. I was really immersed in it. It was probably the most transcending, best time of my life as far as an artist, because it's when everything clicked. Everything clicked. And I think it was helpful that we were in Baltimore. It felt like a big stage. Everything was saturated to help all of us as artists. Everybody on that set, in my mind, all the actors, all we had to do was look to the left or look to the right, and we were inspired by the city of Baltimore, by the people in Baltimore. of how these characters were supposed to live and be portrayed. Baltimore being the place that it was, there was really not much to do out there unless you wanted to get in trouble. We weren't trying to get in trouble. Everybody wanted to do a good job. Everybody stayed together. We would be in the hotel. We would be talking to each other, talking about the scenes, arguing about certain things. We really held each other accountable. If I wasn't shooting that day and Sonya was shooting, I could either be at the bar, I could be spending my per diem, or I could be on set. Why not be on set, watching my fellow actor? I would be there, and we would be looking at each other. That's never really done, as far as I know, at any other show where I can look at a fellow actor and go, that was whack. We were just really, really looking out for each other. We really bought into the situation. It was about the story and not about the egos.
Leo Fitzpatrick, Johnny Weeks.
I know a lot of junkies. I always wanted to bring a little bit of human element to it because junkies are always shown in such a bad light. But they're fucking somebody's kid or somebody's girlfriend. They're fucking people too. They're just caught up in some bad shit. I think makeup was just sort of embellishing my bad genes. There wasn't anything too over the top. It was just like, all right, let's just make him look yellow. It wasn't anything too extreme then, strangely, outside of that. I'd never shot heroin or done heroin, but the guy that worked the props department who showed me how to shoot heroin ended up being one of my best friends.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
While we were doing the pilot, I had a conversation with Ed Burns. He came to me, and Ed Burns wasn't really a talkative guy, but he fucks your head up. You ask Ed Burns, you watch the football game? I wonder who won. He'll be like, is that what you do with your life? You want to watch a game? The world is being destroyed, and you just want to watch a football game? He just breaks it down. Ed Burns, he came to me one day like, you're doing a good job. You're really doing good. Bubbles was my snitch. He was my informant. At that point, with the whole audition process, I didn't know Bubbles was a real character. I was like, what? He was like, Bubbles is my informant. I was like, why didn't you tell me? I would have been asking you for research. I would have been asking you questions. He was like, because you were doing a good job, why muck it up? Then he told me, if we were going on the look of Bubbles, Lance Reddick would have gotten the job. He was number two. We heard you might have had some trepidation playing the character. If you said no, we'd have given it to Lance Reddick, because Lance Reddick looks like the real Bubbles. I was like, Lance is 6'2", big. Why the fuck did you cast me then, if Bubbles looks like that? He said, because you had more of the essence of what Bubbles was about, the human spirit of who he was. He's a nice guy. This dude had a habit. He still wanted to be functional in society. He still cared. You had more of that essence of who Bubbles was. I was honored by that. Of course, my mother was like, what the fuck you mean my son's got the essence of a junkie? What the fuck you talking about?
Peter Garrity, Judge Daniel Phelan.
Bubbles just drove me nuts. I just thought, where did they get this heroin addict? And then the next week, there was a cast party in some bar in New York, and there was Andre Royo, who plays Bubbles, and he's the sweetest guy. He's just a really good actor, that's all.
Debbie Young, makeup department head.
When we first started, he went to the craft services table. We were working in downtown Baltimore, and he went to get something to eat, and the security people stopped him because they didn't know who he was. They thought he was somebody off the street.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
I was shuffling around and mumbling to myself and grabbing at the food, and security chased me. They thought I was a junkie trying to steal stuff from craft service. This boy was ready to fuck me up. One of the other guys came like, no, no, that's one of our actors. They were like, you about to get knocked out. You look for real. It was certain things like that that would happen that really kept me feeling like I was doing a good job or going in the right direction.
Steve Earle, Waylon.
My scenes were meetings, and it was relatively early in my own recovery, so that part of it was really cool. Because when you see those places in the wire, they are places where meetings actually take place, and a lot of the extras are members of those home groups. Anonymity. You don't tell anybody which one. There's other people in there that are just extras. I have people in recovery come up to me all the time and say, those meetings are so real. Usually, 12-step meetings on television, you can tell that they aren't that great, and that's why it was funny. With the exception of one director that I worked with, we were always encouraged to say when something didn't ring true. We were encouraged to speak up on those things, and the writers put it in.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
I call it my street Oscar. We were shooting a scene. I think it was that one time where I sat on a bench and I had no lines. I was planning whether I was going to stay clean and waiting for Sonia's character to call me. I was walking back to my trailer. This junkie came, and he was just walking by me. He saw me, and he said, yo, they're giving out testers over there. You need this. I guess my makeup was exceptionally beautiful that day. He gave me a handshake. At first, I didn't know what he was doing. He's just like, they're giving out testers. Gave me a handshake and kept moving. When I looked in my hand, I had a little vial of some drugs. I was like, oh, shit, this is awesome. I kid you not, walked in my trailer and sat there and pondered a little bit. This is one of the moments where I'm like this. If I really want to know how this feels, if I really want to be awesome in this role, maybe I should take this, see what it feels like. I did. I thought about taking it. Then I was like, motherfucker, you'll be good for one take and one take only. It will be over. You might fuck yourself up. Then it was like, if they find out you're trying it, it might be all the love you got for your acting. That you're not an actor. You copped out. You became a junkie. I didn't take it, but I kept it for a little while.
Seth Gilliam, Sergeant Ellis Carver.
I had to watch the show with the subtitles on, even though I had the script, to understand what was happening on it. I seem to recall the first episode that Dom Lombardozzi and I were watching and figuring, wow, this show is really slow and boring. I don't know how long this is going to last.
Lawrence Gilliard Jr., D'Angelo Barksdale.
I didn't think that it would get picked up. I'd never read anything like it before. When you're reading scripts, there's a formula. Anything that deviates from that formula, you think, okay, this is an issue. There's a problem. This isn't going to work. You read a show like that, it's kind of taking its time. It's developing. It's not trying to spoon feed you the information too fast. It's just taking its time. I'm reading it and I'm thinking, who's going to watch this? We all want our entertainment quick, fast.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
The first reviews we got was from the Daily News, and they gave us half a star. They said we were too slow. A TV show that wants to be a book, or a book trying to be a TV show. There's too many characters. HBO's under the wire with this new show.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
Initially, it was, don't worry, they won't get past the pilot. And then it got past the pilot, and they said, don't worry, they won't do more than one season. And then it was, they won't do more than two seasons. In fact, David Simon had to fight for every season. It would have been cancelled every season had David Simon not been so tenacious. So it wasn't until season 4 or 5 that we realized certain people enjoyed it, lawyers and gangbangers, but no one else. It was more obvious in America, but in the UK, I'd just come home after each shoot, and no one had ever heard of it. It was only in the 5th season, I walked into my local store and someone recognized me, and I thought, oh God, people are watching it. It was not like any show that had come before. I was aware of that, and also aware of how special the writing was, but I was so scared of it, and so sort of concerned to get it right, to get the action right. I suppose that was my main consideration. I didn't really care how special it was, as long as I didn't fuck up, but Really, in terms of it being popular or watched by anyone, that wasn't apparent for years. I remember for the first 2 or 3 years, I wasn't aware that anyone was watching it. Not many people were watching it, and whenever I went home, people back in England said, "What are you doing at the moment?" I said, I'm doing this little show that you wouldn't have heard of. And sure enough, they hadn't.
Joe Chappelle, director and co-executive producer.
We had a cast meeting, when all the cast members come and you sit at the table and everybody reads their part and you go through it. David and Bob were there, but they had left the room, and so then the cast turned to me. They hadn't seen anything yet. It was episode 6, so they'd been shooting, and the pilot hadn't aired yet. But I had seen rough cuts of, like, the first 2 or 3 episodes, and the cast was like, is this show working? They had no idea if this whole concept would work, because it was so dense, and it was so layered. Nobody had really seen anything like this in television. The cast was questioning whether it was all working. I said, guys, it's working. Stick with it. You're going to be fine.
Wendell Pierce, Detective William Bunk Moreland.
I definitely thought it was done. I was like, oh man, damn, this shit. Because you weren't accustomed to it. We're accustomed to it now. Now everyone's like, oh, an anthology show that goes on? Okay, I understand it now. A show that changes every season? Oh, okay. A different case every season? They understand it now.
Andre Royo, Reginald, Bubbles Cousins.
Nobody wanted to let HBO down. We wanted to be a hit show. We wanted to be big. We assumed we were going to be big because it was HBO. Everything they do is big. We were happy and even shocked that this is a big fucking cast. It's a lot of black people. We haven't seen this many black people on screen since A Different World. This is awesome. We also were like, this is really slow. When we saw the pilot, we only had that little pilot testing. We thought that show wasn't getting picked up because it's too slow. TV doesn't move like this. Everybody in TV world and La La Land, they know Law and Order. You catch the bad guy at the end, it's all wrapped up. This is some slow-talking shit. They're gonna hate this shit. At the time, we're watching shit like The Shield. That shit is 100 miles an hour. There's action every 5 minutes on The Shield. We're like, this show is gonna suck. They're not gonna pick it up. Hope everybody didn't spend that money because it's over. It's a one-episode job. Nah, back to the grind. A lot of us felt that way. When the show got picked up, we were shocked. Truly. We believe this show got picked up, or I believe this show got picked up, because I just thought HBO was making so much money. Sets in the City, taking in money. 6 Feet Under is nominated all the fucking time. HBO was like, we're not going to be a network where we're going to have all these shows with white people. We need a show with some black people in it, so that people don't buzz us and say, what about diversity? We got a show with all these black people. Fuck it. Let's do it. Let's just pick it up and see how it does. In the meantime, we're paying attention to The Sopranos and all this shit. We got picked up, and it was off and running. It always felt like we weren't the show that HBO was thinking about. We always felt like we were about to get canned.
Chris Albrecht, Chairman and CEO, HBO.
We were trying to distinguish ourselves from what else was on television. We were a paid channel. It had to be worth paying for and needed to be something different. Certainly, on the comedy side, with stand-up comics and with stand-up comedians, having black artists on the channel was always something that was well-received. I always thought there was a real valuable voice in that, that it was important to include in whatever we were doing. Honestly, to me, it was just the quality of the work, the quality of what was on the page, and the fact that I thought, we're the only place that could do this. No one else will ever do this. When you got something that's good and that no one else would ever do, I think you just take the leap.
Brian Anthony Wilson, Detective Vernon Holley.
It was so urban and so dark, physically, literally, and figuratively. I remember the first day I shot. You normally have set decorations, but we shot in an alley that had actual crack vials there. They weren't put there by props. It was an alley that had crack vials in it. You didn't have to dress it. I was, wow, isn't that deep? Life imitating art and vice versa.
Vincent Peranio, production designer.
I picked the right neighborhoods. I know Baltimore. I've lived here all my life. I'm not afraid of any neighborhoods. I've been down every alley in the city, so pretty much, when David talks about places, I know what he's talking about. The story is more about West Baltimore than East Baltimore. East Baltimore is different than West Baltimore, even though there's a lot of crime in both. East Baltimore is the typical row houses. There are blocks and blocks of these row house facades. It's very graphic. And it's even more graphic in that there's no trees in that part of the city. It's just cement, asphalt, and brick. That's all you see, and when you walk in the alleys, it's jungle. I love that contrast, and I love the bleakness of it. Also, I like the lighting. In so many vacant houses where we were filming in a natural light, or making it look like natural light because it didn't have electricity. Actually, some of the lighting to me was almost like a painting from the past, like from the 17th century, a Rembrandt look about it, the darkness of the house and the sunlight searing through the boarded-up windows. I think the show was bleak and beautiful in the way that looking at ruins in a ruined civilization are.
Dominic West, Detective Jimmy McNulty.
I'm from Sheffield, which is quite similar to Baltimore in a way, in that it was a formerly industrial powerhouse, but it lost its industry, which happened to Baltimore as well. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, when Sheffield was in economic depression. All the steelworks were closed down, and there was no new industry replacing it. There was a lot of unemployment. It was quite similar to Baltimore, but the difference was that Baltimore was hot and sunny, and so anywhere that was sunny, when you come from England, or certainly from northern England, seems to be incredibly affluent and well off. And when I got to Baltimore, and we went down the beautiful row houses and those streets and the hot, bright sunshine and blue skies, David Simon even, lots of people, kept saying, "Isn't it terrible? There's shooting galleries, and there was empty houses and a bit of derelict buildings," and I thought, "No, I think it's great. You should see Sheffield." I told that story in Sheffield, and it didn't go down very well.
Michael Kostroff, Maurice Maury Levy.
The Wire gets you on episode 3 because David Simon is a very artful and gradual storyteller. He tells stories the way a novel unfolds, and so it's very easy to watch the first episode and go, "Okay, and..."
Ernest Dickerson, director.
The show really plays like a novel. You can't just tune in any time and know what's going on. You have to pretty much watch it from the beginning. It is like reading a book. I like that. I wasn't too crazy with the way American television was going, where you had the hour-long series and the conflict happens and it's totally resolved within an hour. I like the idea that this was a serial, that it was stretched out over time, and it gave the characters a lot of time to develop. It felt more like life. That's one of the things I loved about it. Plus, I love the fact that it was shot on the streets of Baltimore, and that it was very, very gritty.
Carolyn Strauss, President, HBO Entertainment.
If you go back and you look at that pilot, there's a lot in that pilot that's obscure. There's a lot of things yet to be revealed. Things that aren't stated out loud. Things that aren't shouted. The Wire? About the fourth show, you're like, "Oh, yeah, I'm in this." You give it a couple episodes. And I would say for most of the shows that I did that were really good shows, the pilot's good, but there's a couple episodes and then you really lock down. It's a slow unfolding of complicated people, and it takes a while.
Deirdre Didi Lovejoy, Assistant State's Attorney Rhonda Perlman.
My first day of shooting on the series, after the pilot had been done and the show had been picked up, happened to be the scene at Rhonda Perlman's house where McNulty shows up and they wind up having sex. We were filming that sex scene in a house that had been picked to be Rhonda Perlman's